Hello and welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers in the literary arts on the North Coast and the Lower Columbian region. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. What motivates writers to do the work they do? And what have they learned through their creative process? Before we get to my guest, I wanted to talk about what's happening here in Astoria this month in October. We're so lucky to have such a large population of people who love art and literature and poetry in the North Coast. Because of that, the Writers Guild of Astoria is able to put on a creative writing festival with readings and workshops and an author fair. New York Times bestselling author of the books Matterhorn and Deep River, Carl Melantis, will be reading on stage at the Liberty Theater. There will also be a social mixer with wine and cheese in the McTavish Room that night. On Saturday, October 19th at 7 p.m., there will be a poetry reading and an open mic at the Columbia Theater. Poets include Cliff Taylor, Emily Ransdell, Mary Delia, Laura Messersmith-Glavin, Susan Banyas, and you, if you want to read some of your poetry. The event will be emceed by Logan Garner. Logan is such a good guy. You should go. It'll be fun. There will be craft talks and workshops all day Saturday. And on Sunday, we're holding an author's fair at the Fort George Tap Room. So come check out some local authors, drink some good beer, and get started on your holiday shopping. For more information on any of this, please go to www.thewritersguild.org. So my guest this month is Mike Magnuson. Mike is the author of two novels, The Right Man for the Job and The Fire Gospels. And he's written three nonfiction books, Lummox, The Evolution of a Man, Heft on Wheels, A Field Guide to Doing a 180, and Bike Tribes. His short fiction and nonfiction have appeared in Esquire Magazine, Gentleman's Quarterly, Men's Health, Backpacker, Bicycling, Salon, Popular Mechanics, The Massachusetts Review, The Big Smoke, and Best American Sports Writing, among other publications. Mike is also one of the many talented faculty members at Pacific University's MFA program. That's where I went to grad school. It's really an amazing program. This year, they're finally starting a literary magazine called Sneaker Wave. We get to talk about that. We'll talk about writing memoirs and so much more. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for joining me. So, Mike Magnuson, can you just... tell me a little bit about yourself, the colleges that you went to, when you got your first book deal and a couple of your other books. I mean, you have a ton of them.
Yeah, it's a long, circuitous path, but I'm from Wisconsin, kind of from near Milwaukee, and I worked in a factory in my 20s and somehow got my English degree while I was working full time in a factory. It was a plastics factory, and I was the foreman on second shift or nights, which meant I had to fix the machines and get people to enjoy their jobs, which oddly I was pretty good at. But somehow, I regret sometimes not staying in that business because I would have ended up being a plant manager somewhere and would have made good money. There's a lot of factories around where I live, you know, but I wanted to write, and I just kind of kept chipping away. Got my degree, and then I ended up, after some mishaps and stuff, leaving the town where I lived, which was Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and then I went to Minnesota State University at Mankato, and I got my master's degree, and my thesis there was called The Right Man for the Job. It was a novel, and I published it at HarperCollins, and then sort of at the same time, I ended up getting a MFA from the University of Florida, where I studied with Paget Powell and Harry Cruz, and I published some books after that. I taught here and there, and I've written a bunch about bicycles, I guess. And
God only knows. Back to your time working in the factory. So I know that you were kind of like an everyman working in the factory, but you had a calling that you wanted to be a writer. And so this is urban myth. I don't know. But from what I understand is you would take an encyclopedia or some kind of reference book and rip the pages out, fold them up and put them in your back pocket so you can read them on break.
Yeah, actually, it was Dostoevsky and stuff. And I used to do things like I would go, we had back then in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, there were great used bookstores. Like I know they still have them in Oregon, but they don't really have them in Wisconsin anymore. You'd go there and you could find any book you wanted for about 10 cents. So I used to go down and buy like a bunch of Kurt Vonnegut books. A Slapstick was my favorite because it had the most pictures. And I would just hand them out. I'd hand them out to people who I was working with, and they'd read it and go like, "Whoa, that was really crazy." And I had to read Crime and Punishment and stuff. Yeah, and I was really into it. I read a lot. And back, I wrote four novels and God only knows how many plays and radio plays and everything during that time.
Oh, wow.
It's all junk, but like when you're in your 20s and you don't know what you're doing, it was just so much fun. I just was like, I'm going to be a writer. And I read books, and that's, I played music too, but I was a music major first. I was always a musician, and I took an English class, a creative writing class, and I'd been okay as a musician, kind of trying to get near the top level in my town. But instantly in creative writing, I was accidentally the best one.
I just finished A Childhood by Harry Cruz, and
Oh yeah,
you s studied under Cruz?
I did. I was in the last workshop he ever taught.
Oh, wow.
It was
Wow.
amazing. Like, there were so many crazy things that happened with Harry Cruz. Like, he was a genius. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
But he was a man that was, had some demons, I guess.
I get. Well, I'm just reading through his childhood. Oh, man.
Oh yeah, and that was nothing. So like, I remember one time. So like, this is at the University of Florida, and my book had already been out. My first book was out, and my second one was about to come out. But I was still like a graduate student. It was a weird situation. So like, I was teaching a upper level creative writing class at night, and he was teaching an upper level creative writing class at night too in the room right next to me. So I show up and I'm going to go in and teach it. I look in his room, and there's Harry, and you got to see him to believe me. He was this big guy. He always wore sleeveless shirts. He had on his arm, he had tattooed, "How do you like your blue-eyed boy, Mr. Death?" And he had hinges on his elbows and stuff. So like, I look in there and he's got his head in his hands, and there's blood all coming out his head and stuff like that. And I walk in, and of course he's got students in there who are like, "Oh my God, what's going on?" I'm like, "Harry, is something the matter?" "I fell." He said, "I fell somewhere coming in the building, and I need to teach this class." It was just like this guy.
He fell and hit his head and he's bleeding.
Yeah, and he's like, "Well, I'm going to go in and teach anyway. I bet they can learn him something." And then when I took his class, he would, I had the graduate workshop with him. And I think he was kind of bored with the idea of running a workshop. So he had written all these novels that weren't going to be published, So he'd bring in and he'd read these sections from his novel, like for the whole 3 hours. And this one was a book called Horse that he never published. And it was they were jockeys named Horse. So the main character was Horse, and he was a little guy. And he had three sons named General who were big, huge guys. And he read this scene. It went on for like at least an hour where they took their dad. The boys took their dad and zipped him up in a medicine ball, so only his head stuck out the top of it, and they played catch with him. It was just like, oh, stop. And I don't know. I learned a lot, I think, from that.
Just, you'd go to his class and you'd read for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about that, so you're a teacher now and you ended up at Pacific University. So let's talk about your North Coast connection. So you teach at Pacific University's low residency MFA program, and
Correct.
every 6 months you meet for about 10 days, and in
Yep.
the winter time you meet at in Seaside.
That's correct. One of my
Yeah.
favorite places in the world. There are no question. I love Seaside to death.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. I go there all the time. So, and now you, oh, how long have you been teaching at Pacific University?
15 years. It's going to be
It's been
16
15
years
years.
starting January. I've been there a long time. And you were my student way back in the day. That's when both of us were young and pretty back then.
I didn't have as much gray in my beard. That's
No, man. It's like, wow, that does, man. You
I
turned
know
into an
for a
old
fact.
man.
My book, my first book would never have been published if it wasn't for your help, man. I really appreciate all of that good stuff.
That was great.
It
Your
was
book,
funny
The
because
Wax Bullet War. The Wax Bullet War, I still think, is one of the really great gripping, true war novels. And it's sort of funny at the same time. It's like you on the page because you're real serious, but then you goof around at the same time. I think it's because at least maybe you don't want to bore people or something. So you got to be funny.
Maybe it's a defense mechanism. I don't know. All of us writers have a little something wrong with us. So now, 15 years of working and teaching at Pacific University, you started Sneaker Wave,
That's
and
right.
it's a creative nonfiction literary magazine. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we have it's a Sneaker Wave magazine, which is on Substack. You can find it easily, and it's sneakerwave.substack.com. Real easy to find. And it's the reason we started this thing is I've been teaching at Pacific for 15 years, and I had some of the most amazing students. I mean, I just can't believe how good they are. But in order to get out there to the wide world, to get through whatever transom you need to get through to publish, very difficult. So I've seen literally dozens of my students have not had the opportunities they should have had for people to read their work, because in the like literary magazine world, you send a piece of yours out and they review it at some magazine for could be 10 months, could be a year. I heard a story the other day where somebody got a poem returned that they had submitted in 1998 or something like that. Wow. So you never know what's going to happen. And then it
Oh,
comes out.
slush pile.
It's fair to the writers. It's not equitable to the people who are doing good work to try to be judged in a system. And then they'll come out in a literary magazine that nobody reads, and you don't get paid any money. And I don't believe in that. I want the people that I have worked with over the years to have the best opportunity to be presented in the best possible light to a reading public, and not just like university eggheads. I mean, they're regular people who read real stories from real life and stuff. And that's what Sneaker Wave's about. And as Sneaker Wave, as you know, living on the coast is something that comes without warning. You don't know. You never turn your back on the ocean because it could just happen a sunny day, you know? And we like that at the magazine because that's sort of what we're trying to do. We have a real story, you read along, it could be funny or something, and then maybe it's not. Maybe it's really horrible because that's what our lives are like, you know? It could be great, and then it could be like, oh, geez, that was really bad, you know?
But I wanted to talk about that a little bit because I've noticed that nowadays it's not enough to be a talented writer or a writer who writes every day to get better at their craft. Now you also have to be a marketing person. You have to figure out how to distribute it. You have to, write your query letter and then get that out there and try hard, try and then follow it up. And then you can either like try really hard for months to get it published somewhere. That might not take it or take months to get back to you, or you can find somebody to publish it on an online literary magazine that pops up, but nope, you're going to get two or three readers. So it's a really difficult thing to do nowadays to try to be a writer.
Right. Now you can self-publish and do that, but we want to do something like that where we have a team of four editors who go through the people's work and like really, really examine it, whether it's factually correct. And it's not just whether it's spelled and punctuated. It's like everything we want to work together to help the writer be great. And then right now we are not able to pay our writers because we're just getting started, but this won't last forever. That's the goal, is we have something where a writer can get published and be treated with dignity as a professional instead of somebody who feels like they gotta give their work away. Because you've been a writer forever. You know what that's like.
Oh, yeah.
You gotta give it away, you know? And sometimes you gotta do that just to get eyeballs on your work or nobody else will see it. But we want better. We'll start with a magazine. We hope to do books and stuff through this, and the benefit of writers and regular readers, not academics, people. So in a normal literary magazine, it'll be open to submissions for a month. And because of the it's so hard for writers to get published, if you open your thing for submissions, you may get 5,000 pieces. I don't know. And like a real magazine like Harper's, The New Yorker, or Popular Mechanics, or Men's Health, they don't do it that way. They go ask the writers.
Right.
So that's what we're doing right now. We're soliciting people, and since I'm the editor in chief, I'm finding people whose work I know and people I know I can work with, who I know for sure when we publish them, it'll be first rate, and it'll be good for the writer and good for us to have their work presented. You know, that's the idea. We want somebody who makes us look good, and we can make them look good. That's a sort of reciprocal sort of thing.
What's the response that you've seen so far?
It's been pretty good. I mean, like normally a Substack starts and you got three readers, you know, and we're getting, I don't know, 450 reads each piece. You know, that doesn't translate necessarily into subscriptions, although you can have a subscription to our Substack, Sneaker Wave, for free. And if all the archives of the publication will be available for free. We're more like when it comes to some kind of a way, we're more like public radio or public television. We'll do fund drives at some point, but I don't want to publish. Like, you're going to be in an issue, a couple issues from now, and I don't want to publish that and then have it so somebody has to pay to read it.
Right.
You know, 2 months later, you're like, you could only see Sean Davis's piece if you give us some money. They're like, nah, I don't like that. Like, I want you to read that, but you know, you can still feel free to donate to our cause, that we'd like that, so we can donate to Sean Davis, etc. But the idea is we want this stuff to be available. We want your work as a writer to be available.
So you decided to go with creative nonfiction. Why is that?
That's kind of a funny story. I wanted to be a novelist, you know, and I think the sad truth of it is I'm fairly good mechanically with the language, but I have no imagination at all. So my first novel was about a white guy from Wisconsin who went to Columbus, Ohio to repossess furniture and appliances in the black neighborhoods, you know, the housing projects and stuff. And you would never imagine what I did to come up with the material for that book. I moved to Ohio and I repossessed furniture and stuff and appliances and the projects of, you know, so I just did that. And my second novel was basically that. And I remember was that kind of thing. My second novel is called The Fire Gospels, and I tried to gussy it up like there was a big firestorm coming into this little town. But it was really just this story, you know, just me, you know. I mean, I was the guy, you know. I wish I had an imagination, you know. I know people are like write wizard stories and stuff, or they're like awesome, you know. Like I used to like, yeah, let me used to look down on them because you're writing about vampires. No, that's good, man, because you are way better than me. You can make stuff up, and I'm like, I don't know, what did I see out the window? So then my third book. Was called Lummox, which I sold literally. I wrote an email to my editor, HarperCollins, and I was just horsing around, and I said, yeah, call me Lummox, I said, this email. I was like, oh, how'd you like to write a book about that? So I had a contract a couple days later, and that's how that happened. And then that was a novel format. So the book is a memoir in third person where Mike Magnuson is the main character.
Yeah, that went pretty far too, right? That was probably your most successful book.
Without doubt, you know, one of my bike books, Heft on Wheels, my bicycling books, is still in print, and it's still that's had legs. It's gone on forever. But at the time Lummox came out, I don't know, I was 106 on Amazon, or even I think it might have been 60 something on Amazon. I was on all sorts of shows, and I was going to be on the Today Show and everything, and the Twin Towers came down. So that was at the same time when 9/11 happened.
Oh man, that's a heartbreaker, but you can't get enough
Well, you know,
about
like it was a lot more heartbreaking that that building came down
Yeah,
than
of course.
my career was right going to explode right then, and it didn't. But think of how many people's lives exploded, and I'm still here. So, you know, I was younger at the time and I was bitter. Oh, the world isn't fair, you know. I remember James Joyce when his novel Ulysses came out, which if you haven't read it, don't, because it's freaking unreadable. So the book published at like the same time the Archduke Franz Ferdinand was shot in 1914 or something like that. And his complaint was, nobody's going to read my book.
So you're talking about memoir and creative fiction. You know, I teach community classes here in town sometimes, and if you do a memoir class, it just gets filled up. So many people have amazing stories that they want to tell. But one of the questions I get that I'd like you to answer is, like, what's the difference between a memoir and a autobiography?
Well, you know, an autobiography is literally like, oh, I was born here, and when I was in sixth grade, I did this, and then you kind of go chronologically through your life. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a memoir, I think, they manifest themselves in a lot of different ways, but ideally you're encountering a person. So you meet the writer, the voice of the book, and that's more important almost than the story they tell. So it's not that the story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, because the person who's telling the story is the thing. So you, when you read a memoir, what you're going to do is hang out with that person for 6, 7, 8 hours, or 2 or 3, depending on how long the thing is. And then because this person is kind of telling the story at a point when it's all over. So it's more about just being the voice. It's more about sounding like yourself on a page. That's
well,
what a memoir.
Well, I mean, with that criteria, Slaughterhouse-Five was kind of a memoir, right? Because
absolutely,
you're hanging out with Vonnegut and he's telling you, like, I was in this story. This is me as a character right here in the story. All right, now we're going to talk about Billy. But in a memoir, do you believe that the protagonist or the subject of the memoir needs to change over that period? And also, you could think about this in answering that one, is a lot of people would tell me that memoir should take place between like 10 or 15 years. And I mean, that's just kind of I don't know. I don't think I ever agreed with that. It can go anywhere, but I want to hear your...
I don't either. You know, one of the things that happens with any kind of writing that people teach in the university is they try to put constrictions on it because it's easier to teach. You know, like one of the first things they always tell writers is you got to show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. You know, so what they're trying to get writers, young writers, to do is to describe things instead of just saying, you know, he was pissed off or something like that, yeah. Right? You want to illustrate it physically or something like that. But they call it tell a story because that's what you do. You tell a story, for pity's sake. You know, so like I think when we try to say that a memoir should only take place in a certain amount of time, or there should be like the person telling the story should come to an understanding, and like you need the voice of the memoir must know why they're telling you this. I don't think that's fair. Yeah. I've seen so many of my students who've gotten that stuff where, you know, you have to check off these boxes that the university has described for your memoir, and they can't do that because their minds don't work that way.
I noticed that people, when they can have a bunch of rules that they can hand out, that they believe that they're more of subject matter experts.
Yeah.
If they have a lot of rules in their heads about telling you what you can or can't do, then that means obviously that they should be teaching the class because they have all these rules.
Right.
I don't know. What I say is, like, writing is really easy until you think you're good at it. Then after that, it gets a lot harder.
Yeah. And it's, you know, of course, there's a lot of complexity to that. I think, like, there's certain things in writing that you probably are in stone. Like, you can't put a comma between every letter, and, you know, you need to know how to spell the difference between its, and its. And, you know,
grammar.
Yeah, there's mechanics. Mm-hmm. And then there's how are you going to tell your story? And I think, like I'm saying, if a person is teaching a creative writing class, it is so much easier to say, okay, this is how a story's got to be. I remember when I taught at Southern Illinois University, there was a woman teaching there in a graduate workshop. Like, all stories had to have 4 scenes, short stories. They had 4 scenes and had to take place in one day. You know, I was thinking, like, did you ever read any short story? Because that's not how it goes, man. You know, I'm like, I mean, you can't tell people that they can only fit into that box, but it's a lot easier for the person teaching the class and grading the essays or the short stories because they have these, you know, things in a rubric that they can use to assess somebody and give them a grade. And I get it, but a lot of people that I work with, you for sure. Like, when I met you in the writing program, I mean, you were like having a hard time. You know?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Because like I don't know, the way you thought just didn't fit in, and like what we did is like, okay, how about you just write a book the way you are, and then we're going to be good. No, but it worked out.
Well,
It's not
that's advice that a
necessarily
lot
like
of writers need to hear, I believe, is like, hey, write how you want to write and just go and we'll figure it out from there.
You got to start with that. Write how you want to write. Of course, you got to read a lot of books and get
Well, and you
yourself.
also have to listen to, the person helping you out, if it's a teacher, editor, whatever, like, okay, well, I'll take that and I won't do that again.
That's a big thing. And you know what? I think too, you never want a teacher, a writer never wants a teacher or an editor that wants that wants to conform. Like if I'm a teacher and I want that writer to write like I do, this is out the window. This is not acceptable to anybody. That's art is about letting people loose, not down. You wouldn't want to be like me, man. It's been a nightmare from beginning to middle and end so far. And that's pretty much true everybody's life. People have to approach their own view and their own being. That's true of the visual arts. You just have to do, you have to be who you are.
So, I mean, what do you see as a future for Sneaker Wave? And then, do you believe that the Pacific University MFA crew will ever do readings in Astoria? Because we would love it.
I would like to do that. We got to work it out so I can come up there and do that. I don't know. I work at in the writing program there, and I'm not in charge of anything. I'm just like, yep. Am I supposed to be in this room at this point in time? But I think we're always there in January. I can't remember the dates this year, but like we have faculty readings are open to the public every night.
I'll get that information out and I'll put it up on posters or something around Astoria. Because, I mean, every first Tuesday of the month, we have the Poets on the Pier that meet up and do open mics. And then we have the Fisher Poets. And, like I said, later this month, we have a writing festival. It's a Astoria, Oregon Creative Writing Festival. There's readings, workshops, and authors fair. Carl Melantis is going to be here doing that stuff. And so, yeah. So, I mean, we're not too bad. People here really do love reading. They love literature and art. And we'll end it with, if we do have somebody out there, some writers out there, maybe they have a 4-year degree and they're thinking about getting an MFA. I mean, Pacific University, are they still in the top five in the country?
Absolutely. And it's low residency, so you don't have to go stay there
What does
and
that
focus
mean? What does
on.
low residency mean exactly?
Well, so you do you go in periods of 10 days, 5 times over a 2.5 years, and you get all the work for a semester and on all your classes happen in those 10 days. And then for the next 6 months, you work individually with a writer.
Well, hey, thank you so much for being on the River Writers today. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about
Thank
what
you
you
very
got
much.
going on. And we got to make more of an I'll make more of an effort to get more people out there in January to listen to the faculty readings and such. It'll be a lot of fun.
It'll be fun indeed.
Thank you for joining us today on River Writers. And thanks to my guest, Mike Magnuson, for sitting down to chat about writing. And a big thank you for all of you out there listening. The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit organization promoting the literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more about becoming a member by visiting www.thewritersguild.org.